funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What kind of education makes a student a whole person? As college costs continue to rise and graduates struggle to repay loans at modest salaries, some people have argued that educational institutions should focus their curriculums on vocational classes that relate specifically to the careers students intend to pursue. But my guest today believes there is also practical value in teaching students to view ideas and problems and indeed all experiences in a broad context. And for this, he'll tell us nothing can beat a liberal education. Michael S. Roth is president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. He joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much.
So some of this comes down really to how we understand the purpose of higher education. Your sense is that it should be more than just a job training program. What do you mean when you say pragmatic liberal education?
Well, in the United States, liberal education has always had a pragmatic dimension. Ever since the founding of the University of Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson made a strong case that a broad education that gave you a context for what you were studying wasn't just a preparation for being a gentleman or being a member of the elite. A broad education would allow you to participate in as knowledge advances. It would allow you to continue learning after you were a university student, and thus was a great preparation for life. In Europe, a liberal arts education really had to do with learning specific disciplines, and most famously, you know, Latin and Greek. For Jefferson and for his successors, liberal education had to have a pragmatic value, just like science has a pragmatic value. You learn very deep, basic modes of inquiry in science, but those modes of inquiry turn out to have extraordinary productive power.
What should be included in a liberal curriculum, regardless of whatever major focus students might choose?
Well, it's going to vary a lot depending on the kinds of students you have. What I argue in Beyond the University is it's not so much what you study, it's how you study it. And so that if your education at the college level is really a training program for a specific profession, that's going to really limit you to the profession as it exists today. If your mode of education is one that gives you a context, gives you a broad approach to whatever you're studying, then you will have the ability to make innovations, to respond productively to changes, or to initiate changes yourself as the economy and the culture shift around you. So clearly, there are some disciplines that seem to be good to think with, that people they're like mental gymnastics, you know. And I have friends who say that they studied Latin and it still was a great exercise in logic, and they learned how to think clearly and logically because of the study of Latin. I myself never had an education where we studied Latin, but it. For me, it's not so much what specific subject you're studying, but that you have the mental exercise that will allow you to respond creatively to the world. And in the United States, this mode of education has often been linked to being a productive citizen and being able to see through the attempts of government officials to pull the wool over our eyes or to become more tyrannical. And insofar as that's the case, the study of history, the ability to read critically and to think critically are very important skills. If you're going to be an effective citizen, you have to know something about how to make sense of the world, its history, and the power struggles within it.
Let's talk about reading and thinking critically, because this is something that you think may have been taken to an extreme in some cases and really is no longer functioning in quite the way it was intended to. We are focusing on teaching students to tear down arguments these days and not necessarily requiring them to stop and consider those arguments in the first place.
Yes, there's a theme in my book, which is that when liberal education has been at its best in the United States, there's been a tension between inquiry and reverence. That is, on one hand, inquiry is that you go wherever the truth takes you. You try to find out what really happened at anybody's expense, and you're suspicious. You kind of cultivate a suspicion towards the world and its powers, and that's a, you know, almost a scientific attitude that is very powerful. But there's another part of liberal education that Bruce Kimball has called reverence, which is that you get introduced to things that many people for a long time have held in high esteem, and you ought to try to figure out why they have done so rather than tear it down. So whether you're reading the Bible or looking at great works of art, great works of literature, if your first reaction is to show why it's not so great, that's going to limit you. That's going to take away your capacity for understanding. We hope that our students also try to put themselves in the position of someone who finds the reading of the Bible or the looking at great masterpieces uplifting and soul-stirring. And because we want our students to have their souls stirred, we want them to be uplifted. We don't just want them to be able to tear something down. And so the tension between those two things, the inquiry and the reverence, is really productive. You don't want everybody simply bowing down before all the stuff the critics or the previous generation said were wonderful. That would be an extreme that's worth rejecting. But nor do we want some smart young people just running around saying, "Oh, that's not so good. That's not so good," because that's an easy kind of intelligence, and it's safer in a way. You know, if you ever go to the movies with somebody, and as you leave, you look at each other and somebody says, "Well, what did you think of that?" You know, the person who says, "I really loved it," is taking a much greater risk than the person who says, "That's really stupid," or something. Because once somebody says it's really stupid, you feel kind of silly saying, I loved it," right? So in our culture, when we only give points for people who are rejecting things or tearing them down or showing that they weren't what they're supposed to be, we neglect the side of the person that actually responds well to sympathetic engagement with complex and beautiful works, be they of art or literature or religion. And I'm looking for, in my students, a combination of those traits, right, where they can be critical and they can engage in inquiry, but they also have that ability to be wowed by something or to understand why somebody loves it deeply.
Yeah, it seems like that wall of cynicism is just like intellectually immature, maybe a step in the process, but you have to get beyond that to kind of be a fully actualized adult, right?
You do, although, you know, it's a funny thing. I would hope that as, you know, in elementary school and middle school, that students they're led to love certain works, or they're led to appreciate certain teachings, and you know they'll rebel against it later. But as young people, to be led toward appreciation is a great gift. I remember, you know, as a student, not knowing anything about certain kinds of music and thinking, "Oh, that's only for rich people," or "That's only for elites," or "This is all, you know, snob appeal kind of thing." But I knew nothing about the music. I never really listened to it. I didn't find it very accessible. I grew up in a household where that wasn't part of the daily life. And then when I had a teacher who wasn't a snob, who wasn't an elitist, who was just loved this music and then kind of opened my ears to it, it's just my world is bigger now, you know, than it used to be. I can appreciate that. And the same is true of appreciating other people's faith, or even the faith of your own tradition, where you begin to experience the pleasures and the of reverence of having your soul stirred by something. And I do think that in our culture today, if all we give people in colleges and universities is that stage of criticism, of cynicism, once they get out, that's the stage that's going to be pandered to by popular culture and the press. Because in our culture today, the easiest thing to do is to take somebody down, right? The easiest thing to do is to send a tweet that knocks somebody down, or be ironic about somebody, you know, show how cool you are by being ironic about them. That's such a familiar gesture. And so to get students to to let their guard down and to really see why somebody else loves something and why they might too, or just perhaps appreciate it, that's a great gift.
So if resources were unlimited and everyone had access to a broad, full education, maybe this wouldn't be up for debate so much. But I wonder if you have found it more challenging to make a case for this kind of education when so many young people entering the job market for the first time are finding it tough to make a living.
Sure. I mean, economic anxiety has always been created challenges for education. Throughout American history, in the beginning of the 20th century, when there were periods of high unemployment and high levels of immigration, there's a great pressure on education to prepare people and only certain kinds of people for productive jobs after graduation. You see this intermittently throughout American history. I think today I understand very much why people are worried about getting that first job and why they want to be prepared to go look for it and have the successful interviews or successful job applications. But today, because of the pace of change, going to college to prepare for the first job you're going to have after school, which is likely to be the worst job you'll ever have, that's a terrible investment. So on the one hand, I'd be, you know, very silly to say, well, don't worry about jobs at all. Only wealthy people say things like that. You have to be conscious of the fact that you're going to have to support yourself once you get out of school. But I think it's much healthier to take the route of college being a time where you learn the skills that will enable you to have a career over the rest of your life and not just to get that first job. Because chances are, in our economy, that the skills you need for that first job in 5 years won't be the skills you need to advance in your career. And so learning how to create change, find opportunities, and to have skills that are immediately useful, that's the sweet spot. That's the resolution of the tension between the pragmatic and the liberal and liberal education.
So ideally, we are learning in higher education to continue to educate ourselves throughout the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think John Dewey is kind of one of the heroes in my book. And, you know, Dewey was a pragmatist. He thought that, of course, people are going to have jobs once they graduate from school, and they ought to learn things that are going to be useful. But he didn't want them to learn things that the first employers thinks is going to be useful at your lowest level of employment, because then you're just giving somebody the kind of destiny of never advancing. We want to give, education should give students the capacity to advance over the course of their lives. And that's one of the reasons why student debt is so crippling and so anti-democratic and such a horrible thing going on in the country right now. Because what student debt does is it puts those, it's almost like you're wearing ankle weights or you have one hand tied behind your back, because you start off not able to fully engage in the economy because you have this debt hanging over you or dragging you down. And so I think that colleges and universities have a responsibility to create pathways through their curriculum that give students a broad education without saddling them with debt or depriving them of the ability to think creatively and to initiate change.
Michael S. Roth is my guest. He's president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Bootcamp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the president of Wesleyan University, Michael S. Roth. His new book is called Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Michael, this cost-benefit analysis of how much anyone can expect to yield financially from an investment in higher education feels rather contemporary. You remind us here, though, that we've been debating this for most of our history in this country. And I was so interested to read about Benjamin Franklin, who I think of as really a polymath and is a lover of knowledge. And yet he was very concerned about too much elitist education influencing America.
He was. And, you know, Franklin is this wonderful figure in American history. And as a founding father who was so much against any kind of elitism and a champion of experimentation. So when he looked at Harvard College to the north, he had this quip that it taught young people how to exit a drawing room properly. You know, that it just taught you how to walk backwards when you were leaving a party. And so he was very critical of modes of education that just reinforced social elites, because he thought the great beauty of education was that you would find somebody who was a diamond in the rough. You would find out something you never expected to find out, and that was what was so wonderful about science: is you did these experiments, and then you were surprised, and then you went on to the next experiment, and you built up knowledge that way. So Franklin was very critical of the kind of education that really was a finishing school. They just polish you up and then send you to your father's profession or whatever profession your parents chose for you. On the other hand, he created this reading group where the people would get together from all walks of life and discuss in detail philosophical or scientific or political issues of the day. And, of course, he was one of the founders of the University of Pennsylvania. So where he wanted to create a kind of education that would be broad and training for the mind, but at the same time that you would show what you were made of by what you were going to do in the world. And so there's that. There it is, right in Franklin's own work, that tension between a broad education where you can't predict exactly how it's going to be useful, but the insistence that it better be useful. You know, we don't want you just to be going to a party and talking about some philosopher to impress everybody. We want you to use your reading of philosophy to show how you think more clearly and more productively, so you're a better citizen, you're a good neighbor, and you'll get things done.
How was the University of Pennsylvania different from the University of Virginia, which was founded by Thomas Jefferson?
Well, the University of Pennsylvania, as it got started, it was more open to practical pursuits, I guess I can say. The University of Virginia, as Jefferson conceived it, was steeped mostly in the sciences, and Jefferson really wanted his students to learn things that were very much alive, that knowledge was being created at the time, and this would have been in common with Franklin. And Jefferson wanted to make sure that the curriculum was steered toward the sciences. And so about half of the curriculum at University of Virginia, as Jefferson started it, was in science and mathematics. He didn't want religion taught at the school. Eventually it was. In fact, people wanted, you know, they wanted to have churches on campus, and Jefferson didn't want any of them near campus because he felt that was dogma rather than inquiry. Now, Franklin didn't have that kind of influence at Penn. He didn't put his stamp on the University of Pennsylvania in the same way that Jefferson put it on UVA. I mean, at University of Virginia, I think people still refer to it as Mr. Jefferson's University. You know, it really reflected his interests. But both men felt very strongly that real research led to knowledge, the immediate practical consequences of which are often unpredictable. But that we should encourage that kind of research, because ultimately it would have practical consequences. And for both of them, that was so true in the sciences, whether you were doing basic research about electricity or chemistry. You couldn't know exactly how you were going to use it. But by increasing our store of knowledge, we created potential for use, which is different from just memorizing facts that you would never be able to use. That it seems like the only point of knowing them is to show you're smarter than someone else. Hmm. Both of them thought education, rather than reinforcing that elitism where you learn a lot so you can show you're smarter than the next guy, they thought, no, education should actually create a reservoir of possibilities that anybody could draw from. You know, I might draw more than you, and you may draw more than the next person because you have more capacity, not because you were born in the right family.
The other thing that's evident, Michael, from reading this book is that a really good liberal education should not be about silos. In fact, we ought to be able to move within disciplines, across disciplines, and to communicate with people who have focused on something very different than we have.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm president of this small liberal arts university in Connecticut, Wesleyan, where I was a student myself many years ago in the 70s. And when I was a student here, I couldn't make up my mind between, in my case, I was very interested in psychology. I thought maybe I'd become a doctor. And then I really liked history, and I discovered philosophy when I was in school. And I remember someone said to me finally, why do you think you have to choose a discipline? You're interested in certain kinds of things. In my case, I was interested in how people make sense of the past and on issues about memory and trauma. Why don't you just pursue the problem or the interest and acquire the skills you need to pursue the problem or interest? So I spent most of my career outside of any academic department. I've been lucky that way, but I've all been able to pursue my interests and had at various points to learn new skills to do that. We just started at Wesleyan a College of Integrated Science because my scientists tell me here at Wesleyan that the cutting-edge research in biochemistry really depends so much on computer science. And so it doesn't make sense for a student in biochemistry to not have an advisor in computer science as well. Hmm. Or someone who is working in physics might really be very interested in genetic engineering and so might need to talk to somebody in biology and so on and so forth. And so I think that sometimes you need to learn a discipline because you want to get some basic skills down. But what really should happen is that you should learn to follow the problem across fields so that you can solve it most effectively. And then you should also learn to listen to people from different fields and to be able to talk to people who have different experiences than yourself. I think a liberal education should make one a better translator so that you can understand somebody else's ideas and ways of thinking and then translate them into terms that are meaningful for you and for other people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with John in Denton. Hello, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Hey, great conversation. I'm a 40-year-old man. I've been trying to go back to college for a while. It's just too expensive for me to go. I've been looking at other avenues, other countries like China and Mexico to go to school. It's $1,000 a year in China to go to college. How can we do anything? What can we do to lower the cost of education first of all, make it more accessible to people in the United States? And what do you think about that? I mean, do you think about lowering the cost of education? Do you think that three classes at a community college should cost more than $1,000 and, brand new algebra books every year that you have to buy a brand new book every time you go to college?
Well, what do you think about all that, Michael?
Well, the reason the cost or the prices, I should say, in other countries is so low is because those universities are subsidized by the government. They're subsidized through taxes. And what we've seen in the United States over the last 20 years is a extraordinary withdrawal of public support for public higher education. And so even a community college, which should be ultimately accessible, it should be as low a price as possible, even those wonderful institutions that educate, you know, the great bulk of our young people, they're suffering because they don't have state support. And I think, you know, I know in Texas there was the talk about a $10,000 VA, and you know, I think that's as foolhardy as trying to create a $10,000 helicopter. I wouldn't want to get in one or send any soldiers into harm's way in such a machine. It does cost a lot of money to provide a good education to people, but it, in many countries in the world, that's supported through the government and through taxation. I do think that it's unconscionable that that folks are asked to buy these very expensive textbooks every time they sign up for a class. There is so much open source material out there now that's available for free, and that could be, if faculty knew about it, they could direct people to for free. Wesleyan and now a couple hundred schools are offering free online classes. I've taught a couple myself. It's not the same as sitting in a room with 20 other people and a professor, but many of the students who sign up for these courses find them extremely valuable, and they are free. You do need a computer and an internet connection, and all the material I use in my class, and I think this is true for many of us who teach online, all of the material that we use is free. So you can find the books, you can find the articles, either make them available to you, or you can find them for free on the internet. And I do think an important part of education for many people going forward will be online education, and we're trying to make sure we can improve that over time. The last thing I'll say about it is I have three kids. Two of them went to one still in high school. Two of them went to community college for a couple of years, and they both benefited in California from having it incredibly cheap. They were in a stage of life where they didn't want anything from their dad, and they said, "We're going to do this ourselves. You know, you're a professor. We don't want to follow your route." And they went to very good community colleges, and they were able to do that by working on the side. And that's increasingly difficult as the governments have withdrawn their support from public education.
You write here about two dynamic figures in American history with particular influence on advocating for the education of African Americans. Can you talk about how Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois arrived at their ideas about the goals we should set for educating people and about the outcomes that we should expect from that education?
Sure. I think the Jeffersonian legacy that education is what sets you free had interesting reverberations for African Americans, and so interesting because Jefferson himself was such a racist and really thought that Africans and African Americans couldn't learn at the levels that he thought other human beings could learn at, and Africans and African Americans in the United States, you know, in many ways took on the Jeffersonian view of education, but of course rejected his prejudice. And Booker T. Washington, just after the Civil War and the generations after the Civil War, advocated that that blacks should have an education that resulted in a trade. He really did think the most important thing was for that first job. You know, get yourself so you can support yourself. That's what education was about. Give you the tools to support yourself. And he was very successful in raising money for schools. He was very successful in making his case both to black and white America that if you do this, what you'll have are self-sufficient African Americans who are grateful for the help and participate as good citizens in the country. And Du Bois comes along and says, that's all well and good, but why should we be grateful for it? Every other American takes for granted, you know, that they get a good basic education. And why should a good basic education be all that we get offered? You know, we African Americans have a right for all levels of education, and there's no telling which person should learn to be a carpenter and which person should learn to be a physicist. You know, we have to give everyone the opportunity, just like white people have, to see what they want to do. And once they have a better idea of what they want to do, of course they can specialize. But education should give you the opportunity to discover what you want to do with yourself and how you're going to go about learning the skills to support the work you want to do. And so Du Bois, at the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, argued very powerfully that African Americans should use a broad liberal education to what he would say, advance the cause of the race, to create a dynamic through which black people could not only achieve equality in this country, but to really fulfill their greatest potential. And education was at the center of his concerns. And he's a really interesting case, growing up an orphan in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a little town in the Berkshires, being sent to a school for African Americans in the South, and winding up, though, eventually at Harvard College, and then getting a PhD there, and then going to Germany to study. I mean, he kind of exemplified this ideal of somebody who comes from very impoverished circumstances and soars to the great heights of cultural intellectual work. And he said, look at me, nobody would have predicted that I could go to Berlin and work with Max Weber, you shouldn't try to predict what anybody should be capable of. You should give them the opportunity to try it themselves.
Interestingly, Du Bois didn't necessarily think that everybody should or would want to pursue higher level education.
Right. So some people will discover that that they have other interests, and not everybody's going to be a philosopher, nor should they want to be a philosopher. But everybody should be given a chance through education to explore their curiosity, expand their cultural horizons, and then make decisions about what they want to do. And he thought what he famously called a talented tenth, about 10% of the people would actually soar to the heights of these various professions, and that would be enough. That this is what happens not just for African and African American people, but this happens for across cultures. That a smaller group of people will eventually create the great works of the culture, but that everyone should have the opportunity to discover whether they belong in that talented tenth. You shouldn't just limit it to people by race or class or gender.
Michael S. Roth is my guest. He's president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative, we're speaking this hour with the president of Wesleyan University, Michael S. Roth. He's got a new book out called Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I want to go back, Michael, to something that you touched on briefly earlier, which is this idea that all fields can actually be approached from a liberal education perspective, including technical fields or vocational fields, that we can look at them in a way that reflects the values of liberal education. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It strikes me that the point of liberal education isn't mastery of a set of skills, but putting a practice or a profession or a set of skills into a cultural, historical, and conceptual context. That sounds pretty complicated. More simply, you can learn to play the piano just by doing scales and just by working on your technical skills and finger motions. You could also learn to play the piano and have a sense of how the music that you're learning to play fits into a broader array of music and art and culture. The second way would be a liberal approach to the music, and the first way would be a technical approach. At places like Wesleyan, a liberal arts college, we have dozens and dozens of majors, but there are some things we don't have, for example, like we don't have an engineering program. And I think we should have an engineering program, because you could teach engineering as a way of solving problems that fits into a culture, society, and economy, so that you understand engineering not just as a technical trade that you have learned to perform, but you understand it through the skills you have, but also seeing those skills in context through the history of technology, through social and political issues you would have to deal with as an engineer, through ethical questions that might come up. And so you would learn the technical skills. You can still build a bridge, let's say, that stands up and doesn't fall down. But you also understand something about how you go about deciding whether the bridge should go here, whether it's right to destroy the marshland where the bridge will be built, or how to figure out how to make the bridge attractive to people so that they use it in the way you want them to. All of those questions, from design to history to politics, all of those questions would be in a liberal approach to engineering. So, in many schools and some quite good schools, faculty in the traditional liberal arts teach classes as if the students they were teaching were going to become professors, like they are. They get trained in the discipline, and that doesn't seem to me particularly a liberal way of teaching. You should teach people, whether it's history or English or religion, you should teach people in such a way that they can learn the skills of translation and communication, so that when they graduate, they can take that major in religion and figure out how to translate it into work they're going to do beyond the university. And so I think that, and this is really out of John Dewey and the American pragmatists, that the great virtue of American higher education for the last 150 to 200 years has been in that ability to create breadth, to create context, but also to emphasize skill. And it doesn't really matter whether you're studying history or biology, engineering, or music. What matters is that you learn how to think about what you're doing in a broader context.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I think I'm a living embodiment of what Dr. Roth is talking about. Maybe 35 years ago or so, I obtained an undergraduate professional degree from a very prestigious university in the state with a major in accounting in their College of Business. And after a few years of working in that first worst job that you talked about earlier, I went back to school. Also, after having had enough of Texas to last me a while, I went to found an interdisciplinary liberal arts program in Oregon at a place called Reed College, which has an excellent liberal arts reputation. And I've been pretty satisfied with the looking glass that has provided me in subsequent years. But one thing I've become convinced of, I've heard more nitwitted, even demented ideas on what is best for society coming from people with purely engineering backgrounds, engineering degrees, and business degrees. And I've become convinced that what we need to do is basically ban anybody who does not study liberal arts as an undergraduate from claiming that they have a college degree, and that we need to move the professional training, like engineering, accounting, similar endeavors, marketing, into a more graduate-level professional trade school.
Strong ideas. What do you think, Michael?
Well, it's music to my ears. I thank you for that. And Reed College is a wonderful place. I don't know that I have the I think too much about banning the use of that kind of study at the undergraduate level. But I do think persuading people to see the merits in the kind of breadth and context understanding that we both value is key. I talk to employers all the time. I mean, I want to emphasize that I take very seriously the fact that the people who graduate from my university want to get jobs. You know, they don't want to sit in a library after graduation. And even if they did, they can't. They have to go get jobs. And I've heard that the following story time and time again. They'll say something like, "Well, the first day or two, the guy from the liberal arts school may not know all the technical things." And accounting is a great example. Is that, you know, they may not know some of the jargon, some of the technical terms. And the person who's gone to business school, you know, is Johnny on the spot, is able to do that right away. 6 months in, they're even. You know, 6 months in, the person who's had that broad liberal education but may not have had all the technical niceties has caught up. A year in, the person who has had that broad contextual education is now adding value to the enterprise in ways that are far beyond the person who's still stuck on, you know, I have really mastered the Excel spreadsheet. I mean, you need to master the Excel spreadsheet, but if that's all you have mastered, you're not going to actually add enough value to the organization. And when that Excel spreadsheet gets updated, you're in trouble. So I think that for undergraduates, finding an education that gives you breadth and depth and the ability to translate ideas and practices into other languages is key. But you also have to find a way of doing that that will serve you when you get out of college. And that's why I call this book Beyond the University, because I think the real proof of whether a university education is good is not how much fun you had when you're on campus. It's how much power that education has for you after you leave campus.
How important is it to communicate this to people who are in a position to be making hires? Because it does seem to me that the business community sort of speaks out of both sides of its mouth, right? They'll talk a lot about the importance of having well-rounded candidates, but when you look at the sort of bulleted list of job description points that are in those online job forms that you fill out, and there are algorithms to make sure that you fulfill those things, there's not a lot about being well-rounded.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. You know, there are a lot of business leaders who do see this and who have spoken out on this subject. I'm part of the American Association of Colleges and Universities, and we have a great partnerships with corporations around the country that partner up with colleges and universities in their region. So I think there are more people aware of this now and willing to step up. But of course, the businesses are under a lot of pressure too. When they have to perform for this quarter, you know, when they have to return value today and tomorrow, they're worried about the guy who's going to take 6 months to catch up. They're worried about making an investment that may take a little time to mature. But I do believe that if that worry becomes ever more powerful, will become an intellectual and economic backwater. Because what's been so powerful about the American economy is not that just its efficiency, right? It's creativity and innovation, its ability to develop new ideas and new practices that no one ever anticipated, and then everybody else thinks they need. That ability to, whether you look at Apple computers or Cisco systems for delivery of food to large organizations, the ability to create new patterns of productivity and new opportunity, that's what's made American business great. And if all we emphasize is learning yesterday's skills, I'm afraid our economy is going to be the place to which they outsource menial tasks rather than the place that leads the world in innovation.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ray on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I'm afraid that there is a fundamental fallacy in your guest's argument, and let me put it forward how so. Life is narrowing the options from day one of life. In every step through life, there are less and less options. Well, you can buy more options, but there is a cost for every option you buy. In Germany, a quarter of the kids go to college. In the U.S., half the kids go to college. Germans graduate almost as many per capita. kids as we graduate. And in Germany, majority of kids are STEM, not liberal arts. In Germany, 60% of families choose to send their kids to vocational school after eighth grade. We send everybody to college prep, which high school is, nothing else. And if kids who could have gone to vocational school and started working at age 18 with a skill in their hands, if they just saved income for those 4 years of wasted high school, that would be more compounded over time than savings for pension average American household has.
What do you think about that, Michael?
Well, I appreciate the perspective. Of course, I don't agree with it. I don't think life is about narrowing your options from day one, actually. I think that's a pretty sad perspective on one's life. And I think it is very different from the American tradition, which is about expanding horizons. It's always been that way since the founding of this country. It may be a fallacy, but it's worked pretty damn well for a long time. It is expanding your horizons. Now, it is true that the German system has a very powerful and productive vocational dimension that's quite different from the United States, where education is tied to democracy and citizenship in a much more thoroughgoing way. I should say that my argument is not that that our students should be deprived of a vocation. My argument is that there is a pragmatic liberal education through which students get exposed to critical thinking, creative thinking, and some of the great works of the past that can be complemented, can be a complement to their practical work in the world. I'm not arguing that everybody should learn really esoteric things that they can use, you know, in esoteric conversations. I'm arguing that people should be given the opportunity to expand their intellectual and cultural horizons, which will give them the ability to be more effective citizens and more productive members of the economy.
Do you think K-12 curriculums these days reflect the value that you would place on liberal education?
No, they don't. They don't. And I think that is certainly part of our problem, is that our K-12 systems are there's a system that nobody's proud of, right? No one is embracing, because it's such a mess right now. And what we're trying to do is raise standards without creating incentives only to meet test criteria. And that's a very hard thing to do. I mean, we need a cultural change at the level of K-12 education that would give our young people an opportunity to discover what they're good at, actually, and not just to fulfill some test author's sense of what they should know.
And we have about 30 seconds left. If you can talk once again about, as a democracy, why this should be something we give serious thought to.
Well, from Thomas Jefferson to John Dewey and Martha Nussbaum, our thinkers have recognized that American democracy means not being hoodwinked by your government, not being a victim of the people with power. And in order not to be a victim of the people with power or of the government, you need to think critically and creatively. And an education prepares you to do that. It prepares you to be a citizen who can defend yourself against tyranny.
Michael S. Roth is president of Wesleyan University and author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Michael, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Roth joined us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer and actually produced the show today with help on the phones from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact this show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.